For this afternoon's talk, the overall theme is the first of the three insights, which is insight into impermanence, inconstancy, change. Some have said it's the most important one, it's the foundation for the other two. But before talking about it, I'd like to review the three cultivations we've done the first 3 days here, because they set the stage for perceiving, seeing impermanence in such a way that it is freeing, it's liberating. The purpose of these insights into permanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, is not for their own sake, not just simply to see those things, but how seeing them can free us up. Free us up from what? I think it's very helpful to understand how specific the whole enterprise that the Buddha had in mind is. We live in a world with lots and lots and lots of different spiritual messages, spiritual practices, different messages for what the goal is and what's possible. And sometimes they all get confused, and some of them seem like pretty wonderful and far out. And we come to Buddhism with those ideas that, oh, it must be here as well. But I think it helps to, when we do this practice, to have a clear sense of what the purpose of all this is, so that we can begin understanding how the practice and the teachings support that possibility. And the freedom that we're looking for is a freedom from dukkha, which is often translated as suffering. Some people have translated it as stress. Some people as, it literally means pain, but it's applied to our practice, it's kind of emotional pain or existential pain or that we have. And it's clearly understood to be that pain, that suffering, which doesn't do us any good. Might there be emotional pain, mental pain, which maybe even does us some good, that what just comes with life is just natural? I think many of us, all of us, maybe have been heartbroken in some way or other by what goes on in the world, what goes on around us. And it's just a human capacity to feel a certain kind of sadness that this practice is not to diminish, but to maybe free us, not from it, but free us with it, so we can be with it in a way that's free. But it's certainly to free us from a lot of suffering. So it's not about having some great experience, like if only it's my ultimate experience. That for that purpose, there's other places you can go. But here, in some ways, I think of it as kind of a humble thing, a simple thing, but it's also quite difficult. And that is to bring the optional suffering, the suffering that is not necessary, to a complete end. And what a beautiful thing. If we have compassion for the world, we want the suffering of the world to end. And to know how completely it's possible to free a person from suffering, it helps if we've discovered it in ourselves. We know much more what's possible then, and then what to offer others or what to support others to do. And the premise of the Dharma is that the suffering that we're overcoming is a suffering that's born from clinging, attachment, craving. And so if it comes from craving, the suffering we have, then that's a suffering we want to become free of. And so that's kind of the understanding. Suffering, craving go together. In fact, if you're really sensitive to your craving or your attachment, it itself is painful. It itself is stressful, is kind of a suffering. And not only does it cause more suffering, but it itself is kind of painful. It might not seem like that when what we're attached to is something really wonderful and exciting. We have wonderful fantasies about what it's like to have it. But in fact, any time the mind fixates, clamps down, pushes hard, it kind of brings stress. So classically in Buddhism, there's a path to that ending of suffering. I like to think of it as a journey. There's a journey to undertake. And here we're on a journey. And the talks and the retreat are part of that journey, the focus we're giving here. And it began with the emphasis on stability, which could also be steadiness, stillness, quiet. And the ability to not be agitated, not be spinning, not be, you know, running around like a chicken without a head, or to be able to be present and not try to run away or shut down. But to be able to be still, not frozen, not unavailable for the world, but to have a stability that allows us to see more clearly. And for that, we have to kind of find a way to calm down, to trust the process of becoming still, not chasing things, not trying to spin stories. And that's not an easy thing to do, to trust just being still and quiet. It can be a difficult path because the whole system is agitated. The whole system might be all kinds of things are unprocessed and still percolating and wanting to come out, volcanoes that we have inside. And so how to slowly learn to process and be honest and be caring and take care of ourselves in a deep way. Because to be headlong fast, to become stable and still, it can be actually harmful. We want to kind of meet ourselves with compassion and care. And what is the caring way to support us to become quiet, to become calm, to become settled, to be able to be here in a simple way, but even a simple way that's powerful, the simple way that allows us to sit like a mountain. And one of the great, I don't know, great. I think it's kind of a wonderful teaching in Buddhism. The Buddha says explicitly, like, to be able to sit like a mountain, unmoved by the winds, the storms that come and go. And then he talked about the 8 worldly winds that can knock us over. And those are pleasure and pain. Usually this next one is called gain and loss. Sometimes it's called success and failure. And then there's praise and blame. And fame and disrepute. And so some of us, you know, one of these pairs really can get us. Success and failure. And we just, it knocks us off. It kind of really can just be discouraging, depressing, upsetting. Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame. One of the amazing things of the last pair, praise and blame and fame and disrepute, we don't need anybody else to do it for us. We can have a whole thing going on inside. You know, that on one hand we're, you know, we blame ourselves, and that's really painful. And then if we have too much conceit, we're praising ourselves too much, which is maybe painful for you, but it's painful for others. And then this, you know, fame and disrepute is also, I mean, that's also has to do with conceit on one end, but also the opposite of conceit, the really kind of undermining our sense of self, undermining our sense of confidence, thinking that we're somehow a bad person or unworthy person or something. So these things can knock us over, and we can get caught in them. And they occur in life, but there is a stance, there is a way of being that allows us to not pick them up, not be pushed around by them. These things happen, but we can have a stability, a steadiness, a calm, a peace here. Here they come. And someone praises you, and you just say, thank you. And that's it. That's all you do. Someone blames you. Maybe you don't say thank you. But maybe you say, oh, is that so? Oh, that's interesting. Oh, I wonder how you got that idea. Tell me more. But, you know, the idea is you're stable. You're not ignoring the fact, but you're not letting it knock you over. And it's not easy not to have these eight winds knock you over, because some of them are tied to existential issues, and we think they do. Just our ability to survive, our abilities to be accepted by a community and by other people, and to feel like we belong to this world. So they're pretty central, but still we're sitting here, and in order to be able to get to the bottom of our suffering and our clinging and find a way to be free, we see, can we just allow ourselves to be present for it all? In the middle of the storms, can we try to be still and be quiet? And so that's an art to be learned. To some degree, just coming on retreat is a quieting movement. We don't have the usual stimuli and things quiet down. And by today, if there's a little bit of luck, you're more steady, you're more still, you're more quiet than you were the day you came. These things go up and down and swirl around, so it's not guaranteed. And the purpose of it is so we can see more clearly, so we can really be honest, to really have the capacity to see even what's very difficult with a softness, without fixating, without resisting, but to be stable and still in the middle of it in a soft way. The second of these cultivations that we cultivate is well-being. And the well-being can be seen as coming from a stillness or a stability that we're slowly building. So much of the ill-being, so much of the ways in which you feel unhappy, are not inherent in the mind, not inherent in the heart. They're there because we're doing something. We are agitated, we're angry, we're resentful, we're afraid, we're grieving, we're sad, we're wanting, we're frustrated. And We have ideas of who we should be that's not supported by life experience, and we're holding on to it. We're disappointed. There's a lot of things the mind does. And as we get quieter and stiller, we begin to get an inkling that yes, in fact, I'm actually contributing to some of this suffering. And so, you know, it might be that if you, first day that you came here, the first afternoon, evening, you're here, you're at dinner, and maybe, you know, if you spilled, I don't know, some sauce that you're eating on your shirt, you might have been a little bit horrified. Now, these are all these strangers just getting to spend a week with them, and now they see how clumsy you are, and this is a disaster, and hope no one noticed, and should I leave the retreat now? But by today, if you spill a little thing on your shirt, I hope that you can see the mind have those thoughts, and you say, I don't have to bother. I can let that go. You know, that's these people here, they're not paying any attention. They're looking at their food. And I'm sure they didn't even notice, but if they did, I think they have better things to do than to be thinking about, you know, me and my dirty shirt. And so it might dawn on you, you know, I don't need to go there. No, thank you. Done that before. And you see, oh, I don't have to do that activity of the mind. And it's easier to come back to a more quiet place. I tried to use a silly, simple example so you might make your, see that maybe already you're there a little bit. I've sat sometimes in meditation, and it's amazing how repeatedly I can tell myself things that are painful to myself. Like, Gil, you're lousy. So there I go again. But then if I get quiet enough, I can see that thought or some story arise that's painful. And it's kind of like, I kind of look up at it and say, I don't need to do that now. It took many days to get this quiet. I don't think I have to pick, I know where that's going. No, thank you. Come back. So we start getting an inkling that there are ways in which we think, the ways in which we grab on, things we react to, that maybe we don't have to do. And as we begin quieting down and not reacting so much, not participating in these kinds of things that involve attachment or clinging or these stories that we spin around, lo and behold, we start feeling better. We feel more peaceful, more calm. And it turns out that for some reason, the way human beings have been built, if we're not stirring up the pot, we get clear and peaceful. There's a kind of joy and happiness that can be here. If we're just here and present in our experience. A moment that was very significant for me was when my Zen teacher said to me, he was asking about me, and I was saying all kinds of things about myself and this and that. I thought he was interested. And I'm an important subject. And so he listened and all that. After a while, he said to me, Gil, just to be alive is enough. And that was a powerful statement in that context. And that really changed me in some way. Oh, just to be alive is enough. I don't have to prove myself. I don't have to gain anything. And just breathing and being alive. And I think maybe it struck me because I'd been a Zen student for some time. And I kind of had discovered that without knowing it. I'd been learned to sit and felt so comfortable just sitting there, breathing, not needing anything. Always before, I thought I could only be happy if the world accommodated my desires. But I didn't have to have any desires met. I could just, if I just sat peacefully and breathed, it was just like, I was so happy just to be alive. And so to begin discovering that as we quiet down and are not picking things up and reacting and wanting, and wow, this is quite something, this discovery. I'm discovering something about what I do, my contribution to my suffering. Wow. I thought the world was responsible for everything. And no, you know, I keep blaming everybody else. I'm sure people deserve some blame. But I didn't realize how much I'm doing, how much I'm contributing. I have one friend who taught mindfulness in a very difficult population in the prisons. And some people are really very, very challenged psychologically and were kept in special places and were not allowed out much because they were so challenged. And so he was invited in to teach them Buddhism. And one of the things he taught them was very simple. Don't make it worse. Whatever the circumstances, don't make it worse. And that they could remember. And that they can kind of knew, oh yeah, don't make it worse. They can hold on to that. At least don't make it worse. And that's one of the things we learn to do in this meditation practice. At least don't make it worse. And slowly we learn how not to make it worse, how not to add things on top. And then as we settle, we have a deeper and deeper reference for don't make it worse. And so we start having a kind of contentment, that kind of sense of harmony, a peace, well-being. And it's a slow thing that kind of gets born, first a little seed, and slowly it can grow and develop. But it helps if we can recognize it, that it's there. We can recognize a little seed maybe of it there and then trust it and don't make it worse. Don't pull the seed out. Huh. And then comes confidence. And I think this is a phenomenally important thing. Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is not meant to make us weak. It's not meant to make us a nobody. That's supposed to be self-effacing and just kind of, you know, not self means, you know, you're not supposed to really count. You're not supposed to really, you know, want or stand up for yourself or you know, you're supposed to not want anything. No desires. Probably, I suspect one of the definitions of being really depressed is having no desires. So don't pursue no desires as a goal. I don't think that's healthy. No craving, no attachment is different than no desires. And to be able to sit like a mountain, the way to sit like a mountain and trust yourself, trust well-being, trust your stability, stand your ground. So as I got pointed out earlier, I like these statues of the Buddha because it's such a dignified, confident posture that's not being assertive. It's not collapsing. It's not running away. It's clearly in the spot where the Buddha is sitting. The Buddha is really there in a relaxed, kind way. But it's really there. In all the ways that modern psychologists say that we want to develop a strong sense of self. The Buddha had all those qualities completely. He walked confidently. He knew himself really well. He knew what he had to teach. He knew his values. He knew who he was in relationship to other people. And he would tell people who he was and what his strengths were. This was not someone who just kind of like, you kind of like, is someone there? Empty, you know, and so like not engaged in the world. So this confidence that you count, that you're important, that you're valuable, and to be able to take your seat with a kind of confidence, yes, here I am, that your well-being is important. Your freedom from your suffering is valuable for yourself and for the world. So there's this journey that we're on of cultivating these things and developing these qualities so that we come to a point where we can start seeing into this experience of ourselves much more deeply. And the way we set up these teachings, the corollary to stability is impermanence. There's something about when you're really stable, sometimes you can see movement easier. Like I gave the analogy of the telescope, holding in your hand, but you need to put it in a tripod, then it's stable and you can see. And there's a kind of paradoxical or reciprocal relationship. When the mind is agitated, it can project the delusion of permanence on the world. When the mind is still, not agitated, not spinning, but the mind is still, then it sees the world as constantly, everything's changing all the time. In other words, it's a spinning, agitated mind that's living in stories and ideas and concepts that projects permanence on the world around us through their ideas. I call it the delusion of permanence. And I've seen it in myself that, I mean, it's one thing of what I know with whatever wisdom I have. It's the other thing of what's operating on my mind under that. It's not always the same. So I know that everything's changing all the time, but I can be upset about something and I'm operating as if this is it. I'm going to be this way forever. I know I'm not, but it's the subconscious operating system is like treating it like that. This is it. I'm stuck. This is the way I'm going to be this way forever. And, or for other people, you know, 10 years ago, someone slighted you. You don't know much about how it happened, but you remember how they felt it was disrespectful. For 10 years, that's who the person is in your mind. Unwavering, there's permanence. Some things are permanent. And that is the disrespectful person. Where does that permanence live? Only in your mind that's holding it that way. That person has changed and been all kinds of different ways over those 10 years. And maybe the person's even done a 7-day retreat. And has somehow changed and, you know, let go of their disrespect for people. And now they're filled with kindness and compassion, but you're not going to give them that right. No, they're that disrespectful person and you're going to let them know it next time you see them. Nope, you can't be changed. That's who you are. So we hold, you know, this, or we have these ideas that I have certain desires, I have to have this. And so we get stuck on it. We fixate on things. We fixate on our desires, we fixate on our aversions, we fixate on our fears. Some, you know, there's psychologists make this sometimes the distinction between fear and anxiety, where anxiety is imaginary. It's a little bit. Maybe those psychologists are being a little disrespectful, because after all, my imagination's good. I have a good imagination. What's the problem with these psychologists? You know, it must be true. I'm imagining, you know, the saber-toothed tigers are going to come and attack any minute, and I'm worried. Shouldn't I protect myself from saber-toothed tigers? I'm sure there's a problem out there, because they're talking about retrieving DNA from long-lost things, and it's just a matter of time before they come, and I should really get two locks on my door. And the mind can go wild, right, and build and build. It can be very convincing. It can be the mind is amazingly authoritative. Maybe because fear gives things authority, because fear is really an important, very important emotion. It shouldn't be disrespected. Fear is, but anxiety that's really spinning out an imagination, we have to be very careful with it. So an anxiety can get fixated, we can get stuck on it. And so there's a kind of a permanence there of that stuckness, that fixation. As we develop more stability and well-being and softness and confidence to just be here, to inhabit this place, to claim our seat here in this way, and be willing to start opening up to what's here, at some point we start noticing more and more how things are always changing. And there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of freedom that can come from noticing change. After I spent a fair amount of time in Buddhist monasteries, a little bit being somewhat isolated from a lot of society, and I went back into the world and started meeting people who weren't Buddhists, I was so inspired by how there were so many wise people out there who were not Buddhists. You don't have to be Buddhist to be wise. And I started to see that there are people who encounter the ordinary, visible change in aspect of our human life, who somehow, some people get buried under it, some people struggle with it. And some people have found a way to become wise and free. Not easy, but you know, there's loss. People have all kinds of losses. I've seen people who had losses because they were really sick and they couldn't keep their job, or people who became disabled in some way. They couldn't do the things that they loved or that they thought they needed to have. And I've seen people be depressed and angry for that. And I've seen people who've been depressed and angry, but then found a way out of that. And found that they could be happy in their new state. They didn't need to be happy through the old way only. They could find some other way. And part of the reason for that is that, again, a lot of the happiness doesn't come from what we get, what we can do, but our attitude and how we hold it and how the mind is with everything. And so there are people who I met who I was so inspired by their freedom that they'd found. They had to find it because they were suffering so much that they had no, you know, it was either to die or find another way. And you don't need Buddhism to that if you're up against the wall with certain difficulties. huge losses, huge, challenges and suffering that people go through. Why some people find their way through these things and others don't do it so well, I don't know. But it's possible to be present and face the challenges of this life that are visible, that everyone has, and to question it, learn how not to make it worse, what you have to let go of. And you don't really have to, at a certain kind of level, you don't really have to do Buddhist practice to do this. You have to kind of show up and really be honest, really hang in there and see there must be another way. So there's the ordinary suffering, the ordinary changings that we see that everyone goes through sooner or later. Everyone's contending with it. Sickness, old age, and death. It's part of our kinship with everyone in the world, is that these deep existential concerns is here for all of us. When we come to do insight meditation practice, there's a new level of change that we're opening into. And that's not what we ordinarily see in ordinary life. And one of them is we start noticing that on one hand, the mind can fixate. It can live in a delusion of permanence. It's going to be this way forever. And we see that it's an activity of the mind. We see that the mind is manufacturing that, creating that. It's a way that the mind makes the situation worse. We can start slowing down, softening, relaxing the mind. And then, as I talked about the other day, when the mind is at ease, the mind is not stuck, it's not fixated on anything. It kind of, the mind by itself is constantly moving and changing and taking in something new. If you just relax as you're sitting here and just kind of rather than direct your mind, your attention, just relax and follow your attention. Follow where your attention goes. If you stay in the present moment, I feel now warmth in my belly. I feel the coolness of my fingers against my leg, the traffic, the light in the room, the softness, colors. Is that a motorcycle? My mind is kind of just taking in all these different things. I'm just floating, sometimes in me, sometimes around me. It's flowing and moving. And even if I get very absorbed and like on the breathing, even there it doesn't get fixated. It's just kind of roaming, taking in the in-breath, the out-breath, the beginning of the in-breath, and the kaleidoscope of different sensations that come. And it's a little bit like the experience of maybe being at the beach or next to a river and just watching the waves go up and down on the shore, or the river just flowing. There's some people have this experience of watching a fire. They're really boring experiences, same thing over and over and over again. I mean, like, what's the deal? But there's something that's really reassuring and pleasant to watch a fire for a long time, or the waves for a long time, or the river just flowing for a long time. I think part of it is that it's really good for the awareness, the eyes, to have this very relaxed kind of moving with things and flowing with it and not being fixated on one thing. And it's kind of captivating for us to be absorbed in this constantly changing, moving thing. So same thing with this mindfulness. to keep the mind attentive here, but to let it just kind of take in your experience like you're looking at the waves at the beach coming and going. Not trying too hard, but not trying too little either, but keeping it soft and relaxed. So the mind itself is changing all the time. And we see the changeable nature of the mind, not because it's neurotically jumping around from one thought to the other, but even deeper, even when there's not very many thoughts at all, the nature of perception, what we perceive now and now, it's kind of just a flow, and things just come and go and arrive and pass, and the mind has its own idea of in the field of direct perception, what we take in, what we experience now, and they can feel this ease. Oh, that's so nice just to be here and just be with the experience as it comes. Sometimes I'm with the breathing, sometimes body sensations, sometimes aware of emotions and feelings, sometimes thoughts come. It just kind of the mind moves and flows, and sometimes we participate in that, and we say, okay, now let's go back to the breathing. And that now we're there for a while, and the river of breathing, just watching it go, come and go. And then as we do this, and we're quieting down and kind of getting more and more kind of connected to the present moment experience, we also start seeing that somehow also that the way we experience the world is constantly changing. That there's a constant, just being with one inhale, it's not one single sensation. It's made up of a kaleidoscope of different sensations that are coming and going. There's a lot of change that happens in one in-breath. There's a lot of change that happens in one exhale. Pain can be one of those things we have the delusion of permanence and or solidity. And from a distance, when we're thinking about pain, thinking how terrible the pain is, the word pain is kind of an abstract noun. It's like it's not really a thing. It's just like a description. But we can get so caught up in that, like, this is pain, and pain means something. But to go and let that soft mind that just kind of roams and feels and kind of get really close to the place where we have pain, and to start feeling it's not so solid after all. It's a lot of different sensations that are coming and going, sparking into existence and passing away. Some are, and there are different forms of sensation. There might be stabbing and fire and pulling and twisting and tightening and all kinds of things. But you start seeing that, oh, it wasn't so solid after all. I kind of had projected solidity on it, but in and of itself, it's coming and going and rising and passing. And as the mind gets quieter but more attentive, this insight level of change is to see that at the perceptual level, the level where we're perceiving things directly and not thinking about them, everything is always changing and moving. And then you say, you've got to be kidding, Gil. Some things are solid. They don't change. Yes. So the bell that we have up here is pretty solid. And it'll change eventually. But I don't know, probably maybe long after we're dead. But the perception of it, the way that the bell is perceived, is all in little pieces of data that come in and then get constructed in the mind. You know, there's color and shape and light and dark and all these different things in the bell that I construct the idea of a bell in my mind. The data, the sense data that comes in It's a lot of different things that, and it's possible to live in the bell thought, and it's accurate enough. We treat this as a bell, but it's in Asia, some people would have treated this as a spittoon. And my teacher in Burma had a spittoon next to him that he used during Dharma talks. And but it's possible to not be thinking bell, but just kind of cruising around with the color, the shape, the texture, the, you know, and I'm holding it, the coolness, the smoothness, the warmth, the stickiness. I just, each of those little things. Why do that? Why not just stay at the level of the bell? Because we're looking to see in such a way that we're beginning to loosen up the way the mind gets fixated. And the more we can kind of rest in how things are shifting and changing all the time, every step to notice all the different sensations that come in with the step, rather than thinking, oh, this is the perfect step. I hope everyone at RSC is watching me now. I'm a champion stepper. I've mastered the art of mindfulness of stepping, and this was a really good step. As opposed to thinking anything like that, it's like, no, there's no really any thoughts. It's just like, it's like the foot is a sponge for sensations, and you start feeling pressure and weight and temperature and lifting and tightening and all the kind of ripple of different, like you see the wind goes across the top of a lake and you see the ripple of the little wavelets that's formed. It's like that. It's like all these little ripples of sensations are moving across the foot as the foot comes down. Maybe first comes down at the heel, and you feel sensation there. And then the whole kind of movement of the foot down, where's the next point of contact with the floor, the next point? And so, you know, the middle of the foot, the ball of the foot, then the toes. Each of those has their own kind of unique sensations. Now, go home to your friends and they say, what do you do for the week? You say, well, I just kind of felt the ripple of sensations across the soles of my feet. And you know, and they feel sorry for you. But what two things can happen. One is to be so absorbed in that. It feels the absorption in some anything at all with the attention really present. It's actually releases a lot of sense of harmony and well-being and peace inside. Because we're so fully involved, we're not making anything worse anymore. We're just finally leaving ourselves alone. And there's something about the absorption in something, one thing, wholeheartedly being in one thing that seems to release a lot of well-being. Just this. But more important for insight is that it's easier when you feel all the different perceptual things happening in the moment, the ripple of sensations happening. You can start seeing how you try to stop the river, how we cling, how we fixate. You know, like you're coming down, the foot's coming down, and you feel the different pressures at different parts of the foot. Then you get to the ball of your foot, and it feels so good. And then for the next 10 minutes, you're thinking, how am I going to have that pleasure again? Or I can't wait to tell the teachers that a ball of the foot can produce so much happiness. Or, you know, maybe I need different shoes. And then we're having shoe thoughts. So we start seeing, oh, how we lose the present moment, how we get caught in something. And the more precise, the more we're simplify, just here, it gives us a better opportunity to notice when the mind gets caught, when the mind fixates, when we get attached, when we crave. And seeing our craving, seeing our attachment, seeing our fixations is part of the what we're trying to do this practice. And maybe that's bad news, but we're trying to be honest. We're trying to see clearly what goes on. And so we're trying to, oh, look, there I'm attached. There I have the delusion of permanence. Is that, and we put a question mark after it, is this really necessary? Is this true? Is there an alternative? Can I let go of it? Or can I just let it be there without giving it much authority, without being tricked into its orbit? Oh, look at that. There's a craving. Cravings come and go. They're a dime a dozen. I've done those. I've had plenty of cravings in my life. I think, okay, I'll just leave it alone. And then you're kind of free of it. Free while you have it. Not free because it's gone away. And so, this kind of getting closer and closer, deeper and deeper, more and more in the moment-to-moment experience of things, we have this deeper insight, and the insight of insight meditation has to do with this deeper perceptual level, where we see the play of perception, the changing nature of it, like watching the flow of a river moving down. And it's nice with that kind of image to imagine that you, as the watcher of the river, is sitting against a nice, here in California, a nice oak tree, you know, just relaxed, just watching, nothing you have to do or prove or be, just you're just watching it all pass and move and come and go and change. Allowing the mind to be soft and fluid, and the mind itself has its own flow that you partly allow for, partly you, within reason, you're channeling it a little bit maybe to just stay with the breathing more than anything else, because otherwise you've learned that it's too easy to get lost in your thoughts. And so then, there's three layers of impermanence. So ordinary layer that all human beings are dealing with, they all can see. And many of you have seen plenty of it. And some of you are wiser about it, wiser because of it. And some of us are always becoming wiser around what's obvious, the changing. And maybe we looked like we maybe had to get wiser today, if we chose. If we lost electricity for, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but we lost it for a while. Well, what if it, you know, we had no electricity for the next 3 days? The Buddha seemed to have managed to get enlightened just fine without electricity. So maybe we could too. Maybe we can find how to live peacefully and happily without electricity. And without getting caught or attached. So we can learn these things here. But then the deeper level is this perceptual level. When those moments, those times, when the mind is trusting enough, at ease enough, to just be in the direct experience. And then there's one more layer of change, one more layer of seeing change and seeing impermanence and constancy, how things are changing all the time. And that is when the mind is pretty peaceful, pretty quiet, pretty at ease with itself, when the mind is not in conflict with itself, the heart is not in conflict with itself, there's a subtleness, a peacefulness, an ease. And we see that things come and they go. They appear and they disappear. All the little perceptual things, the thoughts come and go. Emotions that we thought were constant, were forever, are maybe they continue through time, but the real meaning of this impermanence inside is to see the inconstancy. Things come and go very quickly. And to see that even emotions, they're there and they're not there. They're there and they're not there. And we string them together to make them into a big thing. But everything is coming and going. And to rest in that coming and going, like you're. And then there's a going with nothing coming. And if the mind is not trying to do anything, the mind is not expecting anything, the mind is not avoiding anything, the mind is equanimous and peaceful, when in the going part of coming and going, the mind can feel safe enough to let go of itself. And that is said to be the ending of suffering. Don't be afraid for the mind letting go of itself, because it comes back to. But to see everything arises in passing, but then to see in some qualitatively powerful way that even the mind passes, and that now we know what really the absence of suffering is. Qualitatively, how thoroughly complete this freedom is possible, of no clinging whatsoever. And that gives us a tremendous vantage point to understand how to go about our life and don't make it worse. Just don't make it worse. That's really good. It'll take you a long way in life, but just don't make it worse. So the insight into inconstancy, impermanence, is not meant to be talked about out of context. We're not supposed to build a philosophy about how everything is impermanent. But rather the context is when we're prepared, when we have the stability, the well-being, the confidence in place, and we're able to settle into this present moment, we can see in such a way, see change in such a way, that we start shedding and letting go of deeper and deeper layers of attachment. Until we're free. And then for the next 2 days, we'll talk about the other two insights, which, like the insight into impermanence, their purpose is exactly the same, ultimately, is to help free us from the clinging, the attachment, from a different perspective. So let's finish by returning to your meditation posture. has stability is paired with impermanence. We can pair up compassion with suffering. There's a lot of suffering in the world. There's also a lot of compassion in the world. And your capacity for compassion is greater than your capacity to suffer. And to practice for the end of suffering. Can be an activity of love and compassion for ourselves and the world. Thank you.